On the program this morning, we have three guests to talk about the issue. We have with us a Deputy J.R. Meeker from the Champaign County Sheriff's Department. He's been deputy for 7 years. In addition, he also teaches at the Police Training Institute at the University of Illinois. Susan McKinney is Executive Director of Mothers Against Drunk Driving Illinois. She's responsible for coordinating the efforts of the 25 MAD chapters across the state and also initiating programs to further the mission of MAD, which is both to raise consciousness and awareness about the issue of drunk driving and also to lobby for strong law enforcement on that particular issue. And our third guest is Stephen Beckett. He is an attorney here in Champaign-Urbana, has been in practice here in our community for quite a few years, and he also is on the faculty at University of Illinois College of Law, where he directs the Trial Advocacy Program. So as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thank you all very much for being here. We appreciate it. Let's talk about some numbers, and maybe I would ask Susan to do that, because I'm sure that you have lots of statistics on this issue right at your fingertips, because you talk about this all the time. How many incidents do we see in this country of drunk driving, or perhaps what we can talk about is arrests mm-hmm. for drunk driving or fatalities arrested for drunk driving? You know, what do the trends look like here over the last couple of years?
Well, the numbers have obviously declined significantly since 1980, but they started stalling somewhere around 1997, and the numbers became pretty flat and stayed there for several years. And like you mentioned, this is the first time since 1999 those numbers have begun to fall again. I don't have the specific number of how many arrests there are in the country, but obviously there's too many.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that we can say that it's certainly something that in recent years, we have been talking about more. And, of course, your organization, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, has been talking about this for quite a long time now, mm-hmm. trying to get people to understand just how serious it is, how potentially dangerous it is, just to tell people, you know, don't do it. So it's now probably people are thinking about it more. And we did have indeed seen some of a decline. And I guess the issue is, you know, how do you account for the progress that we've made? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, what do you think that the roadblocks are to getting those numbers down even more?
Mm-hmm. I think we can account progress to many things, including heightened law enforcement and law enforcement doing a great job. I think we can look at public awareness has definitely been raised. I'd say our biggest roadblock is apathy. Unfortunately, drunk driving is one of the most accepted crimes there is in the country, and in fact, people tend to congratulate one another for driving home and getting there without hurting someone, and it's just unacceptable.
Yeah. I'd like to ask Deputy Meeker, say, over the time that you've been in law enforcement, do you think attitudes change about the issue, or is there anything from your experience that over that time you can say has changed?
As far as with the people that we actually arrest for drunk driving, no. It seems like they're pretty much all the same. Some of them have a good attitude, some of them don't. Obviously, some of them go willingly, some of them don't. But as far as that aspect of it, as the people that we actually arrest, it's just a broad spectrum of attitudes and people that actually get arrested for DUI. Mm.
I think one of the things that has changed is that over time the legal limit for how much alcohol you can have has been lowered.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So now it's in state of Illinois 0.08.
Yes.
Is that right? Is that now true every place or mm-hmm. Across the country? Do we have the same basically in every state?
Yes. It's 0.08 in all 50 states.
Okay. Has the fact that has been lowered, does that make a difference in terms of the number of people that you arrest for DUI?
No, the average blood alcohol content, the BAC, in the state of Illinois is a 0.16. Is the average person arrested for DUI in the state of Illinois?
Mm-hmm.
So it's still incredibly high from the 0.08.
Mm-hmm. How many for an average person? How many drinks would you have to get that kind of blood alcohol level? I'm sure that does vary from person to person, right?
Yeah, it really depends on a person's height and weight and male and female and how many hours they've been drinking. So, I mean, I really hate to give that number, but for the point of this conversation, a male would have to drink about 4 drinks.
Hmm. In 1 hour.
In 1 hour.
In 1 hour.
Yeah.
So that seems to me like a lot. Mm-hmm. I want to ask C. Beckett, you know, you've been an attorney for a long time now. Over time, as you've seen how these cases go, have you seen any significant changes, do you think?
I think there's been a remarkable change over the 30 years I've been practicing law. When I started practicing law, I described DUI defense as there but for the grace of God, because routinely you would pick a jury, they would go back and deliberate, and assuming it's not a serious case, it's sort of your standard or average, as J.R. talked about DUI, they wouldn't convict somebody because they thought, no, that could be me, that mm-hmm. there but for the grace of God. Now when you pick juries, one of the questions that I ask prospective jurors is, have you ever consumed a quantity of alcohol, formed the judgment that you could safely operate a motor vehicle and got in a car and drove? And years ago, everybody would say yes. Now most people say no. They truly are buying into what I think the theme of this is, which is mm-hmm. don't drink and drive. Don't drink any amount and drive. And so I think that explains in some respect the statistics, because I do think we've had a cultural shift regarding alcohol. The problem is that most people, I agree with JR, most people, and Susan too, don't even think about it. I mean, alcohol is such a part of our culture and our life, they just give no notion to drinking alcohol and then driving the offenders and then driving cars. And that's particularly true, I think, of the recidivists. I don't think they give it a second thought. I don't think they have a social conscience at all. And I think Mr. Clark's situation is a pretty good illustration that there are people that, even though it's clear and they've been through the system and their attention has been obtained in this instance by going to prison, but he doesn't care.
Yeah. Well, this, in case people aren't sure what we're talking about, I guess this was the story that caught our eye that was in our local newspaper recently that thought, we said, well, maybe it would be a good idea to discuss this issue, because we had an individual that had been arrested and charged and tried for drunk driving, been found guilty, sent to prison, and it was a case where there was an accident where two people were killed, and that he was out on parole and was picked up again. And I believe that he was driving on a suspended license,
or
a revoked license. So he didn't have a valid license, and he was DUI after having been involved in this earlier incident in which he was charged, as I said, was charged, was found guilty, and a couple of people were killed. And as I said before we got going, that probably we could go across the country and from place to place we could find an admittedly probably small number of people, but people who were repeat offenders for drunk driving. And there it gets us to this question. It's one thing if you have somebody who one time is arrested. Let's say fortunately nobody is hurt and that person realizes this is serious and they don't do it again.
I guess I would but take that, issue with your notion that it's a small number.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think
well,
the recidivists, I don't know. Perhaps the recidivists in this area of criminal law are greater in number than any other area of criminal law. And it's because of alcohol, mm-hmm. because, you know, alcohol can be an addiction, and people drink, and driving is second nature. It's implanted in our brain from childhood on how important it is for us to be able to drive. It represents freedom and movement. And so when you combine the two, you're going to have great numbers, I think, of people who drink and drive, even though they've had prior cases.
Well, what do we have some numbers we can put on that for repeat offenders?
Sure. In Illinois, about 17% of those arrested for DUI are repeat offenders.
Okay.
And unfortunately, they're the ones that are the highest risk drivers. They're the ones that have the higher BACs and greater incidence of driving drunk.
Yeah. What do you think about that, particularly about this problem of the people who seem to do this over and over again?
Well, repeat offenders are definitely a problem. They're a problem for us. They're a problem for society in general. A lot of times in this area, I think that your first offenders seem to understand the seriousness of the nature, and they go along with, you know, they can't drive for a certain time period. And then once they get their driver's license back and can operate a vehicle, they don't drink and drive. I think in this area, my personal observation is that our repeat offenders are lower than like the state average at 17%. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think in Champaign County, it's probably, I think it's about 10% is what the DUI arrests now are actually repeat offenders.
Just something that maybe this not, it's difficult to answer a question like this, but going back to what people think, how they're thinking about, they've had some alcohol and then now they're making the decision, do I drive or do I not? Do you think that most people think I'm okay, I'll be okay, and that then what separates them from these other people is that maybe these other people, particularly repeat offenders, truly don't care. I mean, they're not even thinking about, am I okay? They're not thinking. So that what we have is a bunch of people that are impaired, but are saying to themselves, no, I'm okay. They're not willfully getting behind the wheel, knowing that they're not capable of driving. I mean, do you think that's kind of the case?
I think that's a fair estimation. I know that the average person does not believe that they are impaired to the level that they actually are, and so they truly are not good at estimating their level of impairment. And I think you're right. I think the Terry Clark incident, there's no thought into it at all. He simply doesn't care.
I think that the the fair notice DUI law is any quantity. Don't consume any quantity of alcohol and operate a car. That's a fair law. Everybody's on notice. The problem is none of us know when and where we reach 0.08. We don't run around with breathalyzers in our pockets. The restaurants and establishments that I've been to don't have them by the door on the way out so that I could tell if I'd been consuming alcohol that I'd reached 0.08. And so sometimes it's really, really hard to tell. But, of course, the consumption of alcohol is so prevalent in our society, that kind of law would never be popular, probably would never be enacted. As a matter of fact, most states had great difficulty in moving from 0.10 down to 0.08 for just that sort of notion.
How do you – let me – I got a couple callers here and we'll get right to them, but just let me ask the deputy. How would you encourage people to think about that very – if they're in that kind of situation? Say they've gone out to dinner and they've just had a drink or two drinks. I mean, we're not talking about intentionally becoming intoxicated. And they're saying to themselves, well, should I drive or should I not?
Well, if they have somebody there that has not been drinking, the obvious thing would be to let them drive. If somebody goes out to dinner and maybe has two alcoholic beverages and that's it with their dinner, as long as they're not feeling buzzed or like they're impaired, they should be okay to drive. Obviously, like we just talked about, depending on body weight and size, four drinks in an hour would get somebody over the 0.08. So if they have two and they're consuming meals, that's obviously more stuff in their stomach. It's going to take longer for that alcohol to process.
Okay.
I'll jump in there and say something that I've seen. Especially with older people, they'll be on medication, and the medication says it's counterindicated that you're not supposed to consume alcohol. So they'll go out to dinner, they'll have a couple glasses of wine, but they're on medication. I'm sorry. That leads to impairment. Hmm.
Right. There's so many things that can influence it.
So it's the safest thing would be not to drive at all. If you've had any alcohol at all.
I think that's really the mad message, and I think it's had an effect, as I've said, in the contact that I've had with jury people, and I think the idea that JR advanced about designated drivers, I think that's popular as well. I think there are more and more people in our society who are abstaining, who are totally abstaining, who just don't drink at all. They just don't think it's worth it. It leads to too many troubles, not just in driving scenarios, but in life in general.
Well, we have some callers. Let me, though, for anybody who might have tuned in, just quickly introduce again the guest. Last guy you heard is Steve Beckett. He's an attorney here in our area, has been in practice here for a long time in Champaign-Urbana. He also teaches at the U of I Law School. Susan McKinney is executive director for the Illinois Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and Deputy J.R. Meeker is deputy in the Champaign County Sheriff's Department. He also teaches at the Police Training Institute at the U of I. And questions are welcome. We have a couple of people here ready to go. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800 1-800-222-9455. First caller is in Savoy and is on line one.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Hi.
Hey, you know, I just kind of wanted to, my wife and I, we were struck by a drunk driver head-on about 3 years ago, and it was right in front of our house. And I think the other method you need to be getting out is, hey, man, these people are out there. They're severely impaired. This guy was speeding. It was at night. He was so drunk he couldn't even have his headlights on. The only thing that saved us was we were in a vehicle big enough to survive the collision. And my advice is whenever people go out and buy cars, they should go and think about that, hey, these people are out there, they're really impaired, and you should buy the biggest automobile or truck you can lay your hands on, because that's going to be the thing that saves you. And I think that this message needs to get out, too, that you have to protect yourself against these people, because the police do all they can, but they can't catch them all, and they do a great job. And the only real line of defense, whenever it gets right down to it, is what kind of, you know, you better be in a really big vehicle. And it happened right in front of our house, too.
Okay.
And that vehicle sacrificed itself, and those seat belts did their job.
Yeah. Mothers Against Drunk Driving has a saying, which is the best defense against a drunk driver is a seatbelt.
I'll tell you what, it saved our lives,
mm-hmm.
and that truck sacrificed itself. And I'll tell you what, I think that message has to get out.
Okay.
Big vehicles are the weapon of choice in this situation.
Well, thanks for the call.
Okay,
And if nothing else, people really should keep in mind that it's possible you could have an accident anywhere. You might be far from home, but you could be right in front of your house.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And that it's something that you probably need to. It goes back to the thing that we're always told about. Well, you should drive defensively. And,
mm-hmm. and I'd be interested in what JR thinks. I've always had the notion, at least from the years of of having cases like this, that the late at night, you know, after 10 o'clock in the evening, especially the early morning hours, if there's a vehicle out and about, especially with youngsters involved, there's a good chance that somebody's been drinking and driving simply because of the time of day that they're out. That being said, I've had some cases where people were drinking at 8:30 and 9 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, correct. You know, there's actually a lot of establishments that are open for the factory community at 7 a.m. And, you know, so any time of the day there could be an impaired driver out there. It just doesn't matter. Obviously, more frequently at night, because that's when the bars close. That's when the vast majority of our community are out drinking, and that's when they're more prevalent. But national statistics is at any given time during the day, 1% of the vehicles out there are actually a DUI driver.
And if I wanted to add one other sort of theory or issue, the problem that I see for all of us in society is that these bad cases, the Terry Clark cases or the cases like the caller described, have raised the bar, have raised the penalties, so that the penalties have become draconian. It used to be in the good old days, I guess, when I started practice, that having a statute that said you could be sentenced to jail for a year. Well, if you got a second DUI, then that meant you were going to go to jail. If you got a third DUI, you might go to jail for a year. Now, if you get that third DUI, it's a felony. And so we've raised the bar. And so if you go to jail, then the likelihood is you're going to go to prison, not that mm-hmm. you're going to go to county jail or our local jail. So I think that's what's happened, that the get tough on crime movement that we've had over the last 20 years has really sort of raised the bar, raised the minimum sentencing when you have these more serious DUI offenses.
Well, obviously there are some people that the threat of jail time, this is not going to do any good. And we see cases where people are continuing to drive even though they've lost their license. And there are various kinds of technological solutions that have been suggested. For example, some kind of lock that attaches to the car that's got a breathalyzer built in there. So yeah. When you get into the car, you can't start it unless you blow into the breathalyzer. And if you're intoxicated, the car won't start. And I guess that'll work for any car you put it on. But if there's not one of those things in the car, you know, if you go borrow a friend's car, a neighbor's car, a relative's car. You know, what do we do about repeat offenders if stiff jail time doesn't seem to work?
Well, I just think that the judges basically feel like they throw up their hands and say, the best I can do to protect society is have you off the street. And that's what's led to these penalties, these higher penalties, is because, as we see, because of the mobility of automobiles and the example you just gave, even if we had some technological device that prevented our defendant A from operating that motor vehicle, well, that doesn't stop him from getting in his sister's car.
Correct.
And I think with repeat offenders, it's obviously there's a problem there, and we need to work more on treatment and getting assistance in some way, shape, or form. You know, I don't know if Terry Clark had treatment when he was in prison, but he certainly should have, because there's obviously a problem there. And I think that would, you know, if we could devote more dollars to treatment, it would probably help.
Yeah. What do you think about that idea, that somehow as part of, if someone is arrested, they're charged, they're found guilty, as part of whatever kind of penalty that they have to pay, you would have to require them to have treatment for substance abuse treatment?
Well, Mr. Beckett could answer this better dealing with it, but I think they're required to go through a certain amount of stuff.
They actually are.
Absolutely.
Yeah, based on
mandatory alcohol substance abuse evaluation. The judge, as part of the sentencing order, regardless of the disposition, is going to order that defendant to comply with the recommendations of the alcohol or substance abuse evaluation, do any educational program, any treatment program. If someone has an extremely serious drinking problem, judges sentence them to attend AA meetings, you know, to a self-help group. To follow up, to maintain sobriety. So the system currently has that in place.
The problem is how effective the treatment is. And I think we need to continue looking at that, to try and find a way to make treatment more effective and to make sure that the person that goes through the treatment actually benefits from it.
Yeah. Well, I suppose there's a difference in a situation where someone decides that they need the help and
certainly
seeks it out, and someone says, you must do this. And if they don't think that that's important, if they think they're just doing it because a judge has said that they must, it may be that that's not going to do very much.
Well, J.R. said, and I agree with him, that most first offenders, this gets their attention. And the experience of being arrested, booked, having to appear in court, having to hire an attorney or have an attorney represent them, going through a process, having gone through the treatment programs, most first offenders, I think it hits home and we don't see them again. But that smaller group, although it's still a significant number, for whatever reason, they'll get their license back, they'll go along fine, and then they'll relapse. They'll go back, they'll start going back into old ways, or they'll take for granted the opportunity to drink and drive, and we're back where we started.
Well, we have some other callers here. Why don't we bring them into the conversation? And the next person up is in Indiana on line 4. Hello.
Well, two questions. One, in regard, did you have any information about the attempt to move back the blame to the actual bartender who, continues to hand out the drink to the fellow, release for people who are, you know, in situations where they're actually as a bartender? And secondly, the repeaters who, in some sense, you know, carry a lot of damage with them. My experience is, where I'm from, is that a lot of things get done to them, but they come right back, and basically they're sick people. I'll go with the lady with the MAD program that we need to spend more money a quasi-psychiatric way, or just keep them off the streets. In small towns, it works pretty well because everybody knows everybody. But in larger towns, you know, a fellow can get out and sneak around, and you know, for first few times, he can pull it off, you know, and then eventually he ends up hitting something or someone or injuring somebody seriously. I often think that we treat this almost like white collar crimes, you know. It's some bunch of the good old boys. You know, I know enough cops that drink and get pretty soused, you know, but they have enough sense not to do it when they're on duty. But this cultural thing is incredible, and we just don't seem to have the guts to, you know, go at really what it is about.
I'll tackle the first part of the question, yeah. And Susan can take the treatment part. Regarding whether or not an establishment or a bartender could be held liable, well, certainly they could be held civilly liable if somebody got in an accident and harmed someone else. That's called dram shop, furnishing alcohol that causes the intoxication of another individual. But in terms of principles of criminal liability, it would be very, very, very difficult to determine that a bartender is somehow criminally responsible for that person operating a motor vehicle. How does the bartender know that person is going to be operating a motor vehicle? How does the bartender really know the level of impairment unless we make bartenders give field sobriety tests or, like I say, we put in liquor establishments breathalyzers? I think you're going to have a tough time imposing criminal liability on bartenders.
I think the thing that we need to focus on, and this is something that MAD Illinois is working on with a coalition of other interest groups on, is mandatory server training. Unfortunately, many times bartenders aren't trained whatsoever into what to look for and how to handle a situation if you think someone's had too much and when to stop serving them. We need to train them. We need to make it mandatory.
Yeah. Well, maybe, again, this is a difficult thing to say, but do you have – I'll turn to the deputy. Do you have some feeling about how many people that are picked up DUI have been in some kind of public drinking establishment? You know, they've been in a bar. And how many people just have been drinking at home, have been drinking at a friend's house, and they go down to the packaged liquor place and they buy stuff off the shelf? There's not somebody there that's even in a position to sort of – monitor them. You know, you can go in and buy a case of beer and nobody's going to think anything of it. They're just going to take your money and you're going to sail out of there and say, you know, see you later.
Yeah, I think the percentage is definitely high of the DUI drivers arrested that have left a bar or drinking establishment. It's much more lower for somebody to leave a friend's house or to leave from home and then go to somewhere to get some more alcohol. A lot of times if you're at your friend's house, then they'll keep you from driving. And that's obviously the good thing. At an establishment, maybe it's a large establishment, people don't know, and everybody's just leaving at the same time.
Has it happened often that a bar has been sued?
I mean, for civil liability?
For civil liability?
Oh, sure. Sure. That's commonplace. Mm-hmm. I mean, the difficulty is if you can identify the bar or if there are multiple bars, and then a plaintiff's lawyer would file a lawsuit against every bar that furnished alcohol that contributed to the intoxication of the individual that caused the accident. One of the problems with dram shop, though, is that there are damage limits. It used to be $30,000. I'm not sure that that's changed recently, but that was the maximum recovery you could get on a dram shop cause of action.
Yeah. Well, then just real quick to get at maybe the cultural attitudes kind of question the caller raises, and I guess everybody listening can answer this question for themselves, but do you think that it is the case that now tolerance for overindulging, you know, as a society, would there have been a time when we would have said, well, it's not that big a deal, it's not that serious problem, and now we are much more willing to say, yes, this is a serious problem, and it's not funny. And it's not something to be taken lightly, that at least have we made that move?
I think so. I think most people would tell you it's a serious problem. Most people would tell you that people shouldn't drink and drive. But once again, when they're out at the bar and it's time to go home, they don't see that they don't internalize that. They don't internalize that they are going to be the drunk driver because they feel like they're fine.
Yeah. We have some other callers here. We're a little bit past the midpoint. Again, maybe I should just introduce the guests real quick. Deputy J.R. Meeker is with us. He's with the Champaign County Sheriff's Department. He also teaches at the U of I Police Training Institute. Susan McKinney is Executive Director for MAD Illinois. That's Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And Steve Beckett is an attorney, and he's also on the faculty of the U of I Law School here in Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about driving under the influence, and questions and comments are certainly welcome. We will go next to a caller in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hello. Just a comment on the earlier call that advocated everyone driving huge cars. The downside would be considerable, and if Humvee hits Humvee, I think the damage is still going to be rather extreme.
All right. Fair enough. I don't know. You want to comment on that at all? I'm turning to our police officer here.
Most definitely. Obviously, two big cars impacting with each other are going to do some serious damage if they're at a higher rate of speed or traveling at 55 miles an hour.
Okay. Let's go to, Lafayette, line number one for another caller. Hello.
Hello. A thought here. Are drinkers notably safer after arrest in that those with licenses suspended continue to drive, but more carefully so as not to draw attention of police?
You mean if somebody was once arrested DUI, and they then
now the license is gone, but they resume driving
even without a license. You're saying
without a license,
are they going to be
more safely so as not to draw attention?
I get you. Well, I don't know.
I think getting back to originally, you know, our first time offenders, they get the wake up call. They're not out driving. They're average citizens. They have something to lose. If they go to jail, they're going to lose their house. They're going to lose their family. They're going to lose their job. So they're not out driving. It's our people that have nothing to lose, that do not care about getting out behind the wheel, whether they're revoked, suspended, or drinking at the time. So I think that really isn't the case, just because most people have that wake-up call and don't drive after it.
Hmm. Yeah. My thought is that the person who's driving after the suspension has already made a decision to not follow the norms, not follow the law that society has set for them. I find it hard to believe that, therefore, they're going to follow the rules of the road, you know, and be safe because they're afraid they're going to get caught. I have a tough time accepting that.
Okay, go on.
Okay, thank you.
All right. What if you are stopped by a police officer who suspects you might be intoxicating? What is the standard procedure for the what does the police officer do?
Well, once we stop a vehicle and maybe make contact with the driver and maybe get the odor of an alcoholic beverage coming off their breath or they're impaired with something else, we would ask them to get out of the car. And then what we'd follow through the protocol, and in the state of Illinois, you don't have to do the field sobriety test. It's not mandated. You willingly go through the field sobriety tests, and when we're administering the field sobriety tests and they're performing them, the tests, we're actually looking for certain indicators of impairment. And once we go through the entire block of the standardized field sobriety tests, then we determine if we actually have enough to make the arrest, because we always have to have probable cause to make the arrest.
And this is things like, can the person walk a straight line?
Correct.
And what's their balance look like? Stuff, you know,
correct,
stuff like that. And is it customary that you would do a breathalyzer test, or is that not required?
Typically not on the scene. Hmm. Some agencies have portable breath tests, which is not an evidentiary piece of equipment. They're just determining, basically in the state of Illinois, it's to look at if alcohol was a cause of impairment or some type of drugs. Obviously, if somebody blew a .02 in a portable breath machine and they gave the signs of impairment, then we'd be looking at some type of drug being the cause of impairment.
Then at some point, if you suspect that the person is intoxicated, though, if you're going to charge them, what do you actually have to do a test at some point that can be used in court?
Yes. Once after we make the arrest, we read them what is called the warning to motorists in the state of Illinois, which if they're a first offender and they take the chemical test, which could be a breath, blood, or urine test, it's going to be a 3-month suspension if they have a BAC over .08 or any illegal drugs or substance in their system. If they refuse to take the chemical test, it's a 6-month suspension, and this is all first offenders.
You, as an attorney, I would assume that you would recommend that if someone was picked up, that they should do everything they could to be cooperative?
Of course. Of course, because those are some of the indicators that the officers are looking for. And the officers look at a totality of the circumstances. They don't necessarily – and JR can correct me if I'm wrong. This is from a review of thousands of reports over the years and trying a few cases. You know, you may give an indicator walking from the door of your car back to the point where the officer wants you to do the field sobriety test. you may show uncoordination or lean against the car. You may give an indicator that the officer is going to take into account. Certainly the officer is going to take into account your ability to follow instructions because these tests are divided attention tests where they're asking you to do one thing and then have you, verbally telling you to do things and then having you do things physically. And there are several different field sobriety tests. So I always tell my clients, certainly, this is cocktail party talk. How should I be if I ever get stopped for DUI? Should I take the test? And all lawyers get asked that question all the time. And, the simple answer is that if you've had four drinks or less, take the test. But if you don't think you're going to pass the test, then you're not going to take the test. I mean, if you're trying to defend yourself against a DUI charge, and it's hard, it's getting harder and harder to say that. That's why the best solution to say to people who ask you that question is, just don't drive.
Yeah. Okay.
Just don't drive.
All right, let's talk with some other callers. Another caller here in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Oh, hi.
Yes.
As for the guy who was hit in front of his house, about 10 months ago, some drunk driver drove into my house and did about $50,000 worth of damage. And it took about, he was convicted in October of this year, about 9 months from the date, or I think it was July the 19th, he was convicted. And I contacted the state attorney's office to make sure they didn't plea bargain the case because I'd heard they did. And it was a really, really interesting experience to have to go through all of that and to watch how, they're constantly having, they want to change a venue because he was from Chicago and all this kind of stuff, but how they finally had the trial and it lasted 2 days. And it was just an extremely interesting experience. To listen also to ask when people ask me about the accident, it was published in the paper about a couple months later after everybody forgot about it, they would say things like, people go to the football games all the time and they drink and know that the cops never say anything to them, but they're always hunting down people that get out of bars. And I thought, wait a minute, if they're drunk, they should be stopped. But it's very interesting. You were talking about the social aspect of it. And it's just amazing how so many people just have this thing in their mind that, well, it's okay if I drink and drive, but, and the cops are always after me. And it just sort of bothered me because, it just was so weird to be sitting in your house and all of a sudden, bam, this guy drives into it. Yeah. He was doing about 80 miles an hour, too. But nobody was killed, but everybody seemed to act like, well, it was just property. Who cares? Yeah. But I just wanted to say something about that.
Sure. Well, do you feel in your personal case, as far as you were concerned, from your perspective, do you think that the legal system worked as you would like to see it work?
Yeah, well, it worked in a sense. When I went to the trial, the judge originally wasn't going to let me speak or testify because he said I was going to prejudice the jury, and the state's attorney was just livid with this. And I told her, I said, well, I sort of understand. I guess it's a civil case on my part. But finally, they convinced the judge allowed me to speak, and I went into the jury, into the trial, into the courtroom, and when I spoke, I was only allowed to, well, the state's attorney said you can only answer with one-word answers. I couldn't say things like, well, the house, I couldn't get out of the front of the house. I had to, I couldn't say how I left the house. It was amazing the complexity of all this, but I realized that there is, the civil versus the criminal part. But and then when I left, the state attorney came out and thanked me, and I wasn't even allowed to be in the courtroom when the police officer testified because they said I would prejudice the jury, but I could come in after that. And when I left the courtroom, the state's attorney's assistant came out and said, thanks a lot for coming. She said, we just hope we get a conviction because there's some young people on the jury because he was only 21 years old. But I don't know what to say about it. It was just a real interesting experience to see how the system works after something happens and nobody gets killed. But I don't know. It's just strange.
Okay. Well, thanks for the story.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Anybody here on the panel wants to comment on what the caller had to say?
Witnesses are commonly excluded, so I'm not. I'm not sure how that was explained to the caller, but witnesses are commonly excluded, so witnesses aren't all in the courtroom at the same time. And something tells me that he probably had very little information to offer on the guilt phase of this DUI trial because he had probably had no contact with the driver whatsoever. And the amount of damage to his house while it might be probative of the speed with which the car was being driven, I guess I could understand where the judge was coming from in limiting the kind of testimony. At a sentencing hearing, that gentleman would be allowed to speak directly to the judge, say exactly what he thought, tell the judge what he thought should happen to the gentleman. We do have a victim's bill of rights here in Illinois, and I've had cases where, in fact, that's occurred.
Well, we are coming down to the point where we have maybe about 10 minutes left, and I guess, for anybody who might have tuned in, I do want to introduce our panel of guests for this part of Focus 580. Steve Beckett is an attorney. He also teaches at the U of I Law School. Susan McKinney is Executive Director for Mothers Against Drunk Driving Illinois, and J.R. Meeker is Deputy in the Champaign County Sheriff's Department. He also teaches at the Police Training Institute. We're talking about drunk driving, driving under the influence. We have several other people here ready to go, and we'll continue to talk with people who are listening, and the next person up is in Arthur, and that's line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hey, I was wondering if you guys could elaborate, if you haven't already, about truck drivers. And I'm one. I'm not an over-the-road driver. I drive just through the day. And we're subject to random drug screens and alcohol screens. And I was just want to know if you guys could comment on that. Thank you.
Okay. I don't know. Is that something that you can – we're talking about commercial, obviously. We're talking about commercial truck drivers.
The law as it relates to commercial carriers is much more stringent than the law as it applies to ordinary citizens. I think that isn't there a .03 BAC?
It's .04 if they're actually utilizing their CDL driver's license. So if they're in their privately owned vehicle, it's still the .08. If they're in a semi or something that requires a CDL, it can be up to a .04, which is still kind of high for a vehicle that big.
I guess my reaction is it ought to be 0-0 if driving those big rigs.
And I'm assuming that what he's talking about having to submit to tests, that's it's his employer that is requiring that test. It's not the state of Illinois.
I don't know. I think if they – part of their ability to get authorization to use our roadways is probably – a requirement that the drivers of that carrier be submitted to random tests. Okay. I wouldn't be surprised if that isn't true all across the United States.
Yeah, I think it's federal because of the federal roadways.
Could you – here we were talking earlier about the problem of repeat offenders. Is that something that could you write a law that said that someone who had been repeatedly arrested with DUI
it would be
should
convicted.
Have to pardon me. Yes, sir, counselor. Convicted. Someone who has more than one conviction found guilty of DUI would have to submit to random testing to see if they were
Could
you write a law like that?
I suppose you could. I would think it would be of doubtful constitutionality.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go to
sentence, you could do it. But just in general, I think it would be of doubtful constitutionality. Yeah.
To another Urbana person. This is line number 2. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I'm just wondering, in the case of someone who is a repeat offender, such as Mr. Clark, is there any responsibility of the person who would loan him a car?
Yes, there actually is. If somebody lets somebody operate their motor vehicle while the person that operates intoxicated, it's actually a Class A misdemeanor for the person that actually let them do it. In this case, I'm not 100% on what's all behind it. I do know at one point he switched with a passenger, and there could be some other criminal responsibilities that the passenger that got in the driver's seat could actually be in trouble for also.
Well, I would wonder if maybe that sort of thing might be if you couldn't get a car to drive, it really wouldn't matter. As long as you couldn't get behind the wheel, because you didn't have a wheel.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks. Well, so what – say we have a situation – I know in law school we're always doing hypotheticals. So I come to you early in the day, Steve, and I say, gee, my car's in the shop. Would it be okay – you're my buddy, and it would be okay if I use your car? And you say, sure. And you give me the keys. And at that point, I'm perfectly sober. Right. Later on in the day, though, I have your car, and then we get in a situation. Can you be held liable because in the morning you gave me your keys and I was fine, but later on I'm drunk?
My law school answer is no criminal liability, no civil liability under that factual situation. I have to have some element of knowledge regarding the the intoxication to have civil or criminal liability.
But again, to go back to the example, if you know that I'm intoxicated, you give me your keys and say, here,
guys. Let's change the facts and get it closer.
Okay.
When you came to get my car, you said, and I'm going to get drunk. I'm going to drink as much as I can. I'm going to get drunk. And I said, oh, that's okay. Use my car. Now you've got a closer factual situation where there could be arguable civil liability, criminal liability. Yeah, I suppose it's potentially there. I think the law that JR is referring to is when I have reason to know or should know that you're intoxicated and I go ahead and give you my keys.
Oh, okay. All right. Maybe we can try and get one more caller here. This is also Urbana, line one. Hello.
I'd like to know what the panel thinks of the suggestion made by the earlier caller that we should get larger vehicles as a defense. And it particularly concerns me because, for example, if the person who caused that accident had followed the survivor's advice, you know, he may have been driving a larger car, and it just seems to lead to an escalation in vehicle size.
Okay. I don't know. Do you have, as a police officer, you've probably seen a lot of car accidents in your time. Have you had some thought about that?
I think with the safety equipment on vehicles nowadays, with the airbags, the seat belts, the side airbags, I think basically a lot of cars are safe. Obviously, if a drunk driver's in a much bigger car, say a large truck, then and hits a small car, there's going to be a lot more damage. But with the airbags and the seat belts and going through the proper safety stuff, I mean, we've seen people that have lived out of some serious accidents that you would think that it wouldn't be possible.
Okay. Anybody else want to comment? Okay. I think that's probably about the best response that we can give you. I appreciate the question. Maybe we'll try and do one more at least. Let's go to Champagne Line 3. Hello.
Good morning. I missed the beginning of your show. I do a lot of exercise work, and especially with seniors. I'm wondering if there's certain illnesses or a certain age where the sobriety test becomes less reliable.
Well, the standardized field sobriety tests, when they were actually first initiated back in the 70s, there was nobody that went through the testing that was 65 years or older or 50 pounds or more overweight. Doesn't necessarily mean that you can't actually administer the tests on them, but if you have to take things into consideration. Obviously, if somebody's walking with a cane or broken leg or some type of medical impairment, we can't have them do the standardized field sobriety tests. Then we go back to certain things like a partial alphabet test, a partial counting backwards, or a finger-to-thumb counting test that we actually utilize.
One of the great innovations over the last 20 years, and I know this was supported by MAD, so maybe Susan will agree or disagree, is videotape. Videotape for law enforcement agencies in making DUI arrests, because in my judgment as a criminal defense attorney, many times the case is clear either way, that in fact the officer made an error in judgment, or in fact the guy is obviously impaired.
I would agree. MAD certainly supports the video systems.
Okay. Does that get your question, Carl?
Yes. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. I guess Steve did mention earlier, and maybe it's worth mentioning again, that it's possible that someone, and it could be someone of any age, and not just necessarily someone who is older, but it is also possible that some people could be taking prescription medications that would interact adversely with alcohol, and certainly you should be told, and I would expect that you would be told, that you should not drink while you're taking this, but you know,
I think most of those prescriptions actually have on the bottle
a little
when you
sticky
receive
that
them.
Says
yes,
don't.
That's right.
Yeah, don't do that. What? Just real quickly. What do you think about random stops, setting up random roadblocks, and stopping everybody who comes through just to check?
I don't like them, but they've been upheld. So, you know, to me, we're sacrificing our freedom in the name of society's security. They certainly have proven to be effective, and they've been upheld.
And maybe that's the subject for another
right.
show. Do you think, Deputy? Do you think that that's a useful thing? Just setting up a place and just stopping everybody and checking out everybody who comes through.
Yes, obviously. Then we're looking at the impaired driver. We're also looking for other things. You're looking for making sure that people have all their insurance information. You know, that's just as as much a problem, too, that people don't have insurance on their vehicles. So we're not just looking for intoxicated drivers. You're looking for safety issues and things like that. But as far as the DUI aspect of it, yes, they're very effective.
You agree?
Yeah. The key to sobriety checkpoints is make them highly publicized, because then it becomes a deterrent. And statistics show that highly publicized checkpoints reduce the incident of drunk driving by 18% to 24%.
Okay. Well, I think we're just about at the point where we're going to have to finish. And I will again thank our guests, Deputy J.R. Meeker from the Champaign County Sheriff's Department, Susan McKinney, she's the Executive Director for Mothers Against Drunk Driving Illinois, and Steve Beckett. He's an attorney and also teaches the law school here at U of I in Urbana-Champaign. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.